Okay, it's the 23rd, and we're going to finish up Bonds today. I think we're going to finish up Bonds, and then do a little bit in chapter 18, which is really not chapter 18. I just made it lecture notes, and that is hybrid securities, convertible bonds, convertible preferred stock, and we may, not sure, depends how things go over the next 2 days, have exam number 4, which will cover bonds, 9 and 10, boring. A few questions, which I will give you the questions and the answers for preferred hybrid securities. And then, all important Thursday, we should finish up, and we should have time to review the worksheets, asset allocation, where we tie the entire semester together. And then we'll be done the class. No, actually, not really. We have other stuff to cover, but most of it you only want to know so you can stay away from these things. But we will have gone through the major investment alternatives, and then we'll have a few, you know, alternative investments. Spend a little time with real estate, which is a very good alternative for some people, but not everybody. And how are you guys? What do you guys have the best class? I've never had a class. 21% in just 12 weeks, not even 11 weeks. Amazing. And I think a lot of it has to do with Qualcomm making, Ernesto was asking me what happened. They settled their deal with Apple so that they don't owe billions of dollars to Apple for impinging on their copyrights because Apple wants the 5G technology. And then, of course, you guys did a great job with PG&E. But Intel, look at Alibaba. We got rid of Canopy Growth Corporation. But we added, where is it? Where's Vail Resorts? Is that the next page? Oh, because it's MTA. MTA, right. Go Bob. It should be at the bottom. Yeah. So I went to the library, and I looked up Vail. Where is it? Here it is. And they're not too excited about it. However, the last time they did it, they do their things every couple of weeks, right? No, I wanted to do this one. Where is it? Come on. That one. Okay. The last time they produced a report on, you know what, I'm going to get rid of Yahoo and see if that does the job. Let's see if that does it. That shuts it up. That might have shut it up. Good. Okay. No, it didn't. Okay. Okay, let's save this guy. I'm going to save him. My apologies. I wanted to save that. New text document. Come on. Damn. This thing is so slow. Okay, now let's get rid of this. Get rid of that. It shuts it up. Are you going to shut up now? No, it's still not going to shut up. What is going on? Why is it making that noise? Still making the noise. Okay. They were not too excited about Vail. Vail Resorts, can you read that? Reported weaker than expected results for the first quarter of fiscal 2019. Revenue was well short of their estimate. Heavily impacted by the Perisher ski resort, which is Australia, which I guess they had problems with. Stock fell nearly 18%, but has since recovered. And so they're not too excited about it. Resort shares are untimely at this juncture. Appreciation potential over the 3 to 5 year haul is subpar. This was February 1st. If you look at the price then, when they were looking at it, was 184, and it's now 218, right? So it's had a pretty big jump. And you notice that they believe in the next, you know, 3-5 years, it's going to be anywhere from 220 or so to 330 or 340. So it's already jumped quite a bit. But if you look at their, it doesn't show very well. Can you, on the right side, down twice. If you look at their, down twice on the right side. No, no. On the right side, down. Right. Your other right. No. Okay. This guy, right side. Down twice.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I know. I remember, everything in this campus is low bid. If you look at their... Where is it? Not that one. That one. If you look at their estimates for revenue growth, where is it? Cash flow, earnings, dividend growth. I don't know. I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, this is pretty optimistic, so I don't know why they're down on the stock, but it looks pretty amazing. We would want to do a discounted cash flow, constant perpetual growth model. But it actually looks not too bad when you go back to the other guy. This one. Why is it making that damn noise? We're going to have to mute it. Mute the sound. That's what I'm going to do. Mute the sound. That'll work. If you look at that, that's pretty impressive. Look at the dividend growth. I think it's going to do another... I like dividends. Cash flow is growing. Revenues are growing. I don't know why they're not too excited about this. It looks pretty good to me. Anyway, comments, criticism, thoughts? No? No thoughts? Okay. None at all? Okay. Who's got a good joke? Anybody got a good joke? Nobody? Oh, it's real quiet today. Huh? What? You suck at jokes? Well, did I tell you about the fire at the circus? It was intense. See, intense. It was a fire. It was intense. Hard to believe they could get worse, right? No, they can't. How about I told you about the two guys who stole the calendar? They each got 6 months. Yeah, that was one of the students told me that. Okay, so we have gone through bond pricing, right? No, bond yield. We talked about bond yield. And we had gotten to yield to maturity, right? And then we had done yield to call. Do you remember this? We'll go over it again. Get your packages out for chapter 10 if you don't have them. And then this is where we were, as I remember. Tax equivalent yield. We had not done this yet. Is that my understanding? We hadn't done the last one, last question? We did the first two questions, right? Yeah. Okay, for anybody need a... you need one, obviously. Okay. So we had done problems 1 and 2. But we had not done 3 yet. Is that true? Okay, so it's time now for taxable equivalent yield. So we went through the current yield, the yield to maturity, the yield to call. We'll do them again. Now we're going to take a look at taxable equivalent yield and double tax-free equivalent yield. Because as we said, the feds can't tax the states can't tax the feds. So muni bonds are non-taxable at the federal level. And if you buy a bond in your state, for us, California, you don't pay state income taxes. So the formulas are not that difficult, but the double tax-free one's a little tricky, as we'll see in a minute. But to do the taxable equivalent yield, we take the muni bond yield, the stated rate, the coupon rate, the nominal rate, and we divide it by 1 minus the federal marginal bracket. So what happens is you have to know your bracket. You have to know if you're in a high tax bracket or a low tax bracket. So in this case, we have a person who's in the 25% tax bracket. It's a 6% yield. So what is the bond paying us? 6% bond pays? $60, right? 5% bond pays? Yeah, okay. So it's paying us $60. But we don't have to pay taxes on that. So how do we compare that to a fully taxable corporate bond or a fully taxable treasury bond. We take 6% minus 1 minus our marginal tax bracket. And this is where it changes depending on who you are. Some people are in a lower tax bracket, some people are in a higher tax bracket. So 1 minus 0.25 is 0.75. If you take 0.06 divided by 0.75, you get 0.08. Which means you have to go out and find a corporate bond paying at least 8% to be equivalent to this 6% bond paying. Well, how much is a 6% bond paying? Everybody should say. How much is an 8% bond paying? Well, wait a minute. Wouldn't you rather have $80 instead of $60? No. Because what's going to happen? Right. What if it's what tax bracket is this person in? What tax bracket is the person in? Okay, sometimes they ask questions that are impossible to answer. But just want to see if you're awake here. So 80 times 0.25? $20. You got to pay $20 to the IRS. So you see why it's taxable equivalent? We get $60 with the muni bond, which we get to keep. With the corporate bond, we get $80, but we got to pay $20 to the IRS. That's why it's called taxable equivalent. And you must do this calculation because you can't compare the two until you've done it. You've got to be able to compare the two. Cool? Okay, that's number... Okay, we're not done yet. We're not done yet. Because now we're going to take a look at the double tax rate. The double tax rate, or the, as the IRS likes to say, tax exempt, means that, look, you don't have to pay, you never have to pay, well, there's a few exceptions, but you don't normally pay a tax, federal tax on a muni bond. But if you are a citizen of the state, in this case, California says, hey, no problem. You don't have to pay state income taxes. Now, there are two formulas. The one is the more simpler one, which is fine, but most people in these high tax brackets are going to itemize their deductions. The formula on the next slide assumes that you itemize deductions on your federal income taxes and deduct the state income taxes, which is very typical for people in that tax bracket. However, some people don't itemize, in which case you'd use a simpler formula, which is the one we use in Business 121, and we'll show it to you also. But here it is. It's a little tricky because it's got all these parentheses and stuff, but it's not that hard. So this is the double tax exempt, double tax free, whatever one you use. You take the muni yield, and you divide it by 1 minus the Fed rate, but then you got to add the state rate. But because, see, in the 121 class, we just do this. We just do this. We just take 1 minus the Fed plus the state. But that's not realistic for many mutual fund, municipal bond investors, because they're in high tax brackets and they itemize their deductions. So what we need to do is we need to take the state rate and then multiply it times 1 minus the federal rate again. It seems a little redundant, right? It seems a little Department of Redundancy Department. But it's actually not that hard. You just start from the middle, start from the inside, and work your way out. So this is the same bond, 6%. We're in the 25% Fed bracket, and we're in the 8% state bracket. So let's go to the middle. What's 1 minus the Fed rate? What's the Fed rate? Tough question, folks. 25%. So what's 1 minus that? 75. The state rate is 8%. So 8% times 0.75. Get your calculators. Come on. Get those fingers flying. Who needs a business? Who needs a chapter 10? Did you get one? Chapter 10, you have it? Okay. 0.06, right. And then we add that to the state rate, 0.25, right? Add that to the federal rate. I'm sorry, the federal rate. So what's that? 0.31. And then don't forget the... No, it's a little tedious, but you just do it. It's not a big deal. 1 minus 0.31... 0.69, take the 6% divided by 0.69, and we wind up with about 8.7%, right? Is that what you got? Piece of cake? Okay, let's do number three on the first worksheet. So here's a married couple. Everybody got it? Married couple from California, 35% Fed bracket. So what does that mean? That means they're making $500,000-$600,000 a year. Not too shabby, right? 11% California bracket, which is why they want to move to Arizona or Nevada. Okay, and so the weather sucks. All right, so they're considering a 5% Arizona bond, a 4.5% California bond, and a 7% corporate bond. Do we ever do a calculation with the corporate bonds? No, never. Say never. Do we ever do a calculation with the corporate bonds?
Never.
No. You get a sopapo if you do it. Don't do it. Just leave it alone because it's already fully taxable. So how much is this one giving us? 7% bond is giving us? How much interest are we going to get? 7% bond? What's your name, Bob? $70, right. How much is this guy giving us? $45? How much is this guy giving us? 50. It's that simple. Don't mess up. Okay. Now, so you just look at that and you say, oh, well, this is more money, right? No, we have to do the taxable equivalent yield. So for the Arizona, because it's a California couple, they would use the first formula. They would say, take the muni bond yield divided by 1 minus the marginal tax bracket, federal. So what's the muni bond yield for Arizona? 5% divided by 1 minus what bracket are they in? 35%, everybody except... Okay, so 0.05. Okay, 1 minus 0.35. 0.65. So how much is the Arizona bond paying us on an after-tax basis? 0.769 and then... 2.3, yeah. We can do 7.69. You can leave it just like that, or move the decimal to the... So right off the bat, we know that the Arizona bond is paying us more. It's paying us 7.69. Oh, this one's gone. Throw that away. He's not even watching. Throw that one away. So it's paying us 7.69 on an after-tax basis. So now we need to do the California bond. But the California bond, because it's a California couple, they don't pay federal income taxes, they don't pay state. So we need the more sophisticated double tax-free muni bond. And so what's the muni bond yield? Everyone, come on. What's the muni bond yield? 4.8. If you don't say anything, I'm just saying, oh, I'm sleeping. Some of you guys are like us. As a math major, we perfected the art of sleeping with our eyes closed.
Open?
Open, yeah, eyes open. Yeah, right. That's what I meant. Okay, so what's the federal rate? What's the federal rate?
30%.
See, I'm not even awake. 35% plus the state rate? 11% times 1 minus the federal rate again. So, 1 minus the federal rate, 1 minus 0.35, 0.65, 11%, 0.11 times 0.65, 0.07 something?
0.0715.
715? Okay, then you add the 0.35 to that. Come on, folks. 0.4215, and then take the 1 minus that. 1 minus 0.4215. You should be doing it on your calculator, please.
0.5785.
5785. 0.045. So the 4.5% divided by 0.5. Maybe some of you are just thinking, this is easy, Piana. Why do we have to go to this? I don't know. I'm just trying to make sure you guys understand it. So what is it?
0.0777.
So 7.77. You sure you didn't? What was the last number here? 0.7777?
Yeah.
7778. So it would be 7, you know, be careful. You have to be careful rounding. If you don't round, you go out to the big wide world, you don't round correctly, you're going to make us look bad. So don't do that. So the California bond turns out to be the best deal. It's not particularly hard, is it? Any questions, any thoughts? You do it a few times. We have 3 worksheets, and you'll be fine. So the California bond offers us the best after tax. We get to keep more money after we pay the tax man. All right. Now, yield spread. We already discussed spreads in the context of stocks, right? The ask and the bid price, and that's how the market makers make their money. Well, spread in this case is the same idea. It's a difference. But it talks about the different sectors of the bond market. Long bonds, intermediate, short-term bonds. In general, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate. The longer the maturity, the higher the rate. Just as when you go to your mortgage broker and say, I'd like to get a 30-year loan, they'll quote you 4, 4.5%. If you say, I'll take a 15-year loan, they'll say, oh, 3.5%. Why? Because there's a lot fewer years for something to go wrong. The longer your money is going to be out there, the more chances for things to go bad. So we'll give you a better rate if you bring us the money back sooner. Plus, the higher the rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate, and vice versa. And this is what you experience. If you have a low credit score, they're going to jack up your interest rate. If you have a very high credit score, you're going to get a better rate. Treasuries carries the lowest rates, munis being next, and then corporate bonds the highest, which makes sense, right? The Treasury is, I don't care what anybody says, the Treasury's not going bankrupt. Every once in a while, a municipality does go belly up, but it's very, very unusual. And then corporations from time to time, especially during recessions, do go belly up. So this is from Fidelity, which is actually, I mean, they're a pretty sharp group, though. Very good marketing organization. And they will allow you to get 50, 60, 70,000 bond quotes. You got to sign up as a client. But if you go to their website, they give you this for free. And this is part of the Chapter 9 assignment, which some of you have already done. It shows you the various spreads. This is the cool thing. You know, short-term interest rates have been 0%, had been 0% for several years. And now the Federal Reserve has been pushing them up. But at the same time, look at the long end. You know, 2.4, 2.44 for 3 months and 6 months. 2.37, 2.31 for 2 year, 3 year, 2.33. That doesn't make any sense. And that's very unusual. We'll discuss it in a few slides. But then out to almost 3%, 2.92 for 30 years. This is why I'm really not excited about bonds, because I don't want to get 3% for 30 years. But that's what people are signing up for. Right now, people are buying the 30-year Treasury bond and getting less than 3%. If you go out to, they don't have 30-year munis. What do they have? Yeah, they have 30-year munis. You go out 30-year munis, you're getting 3.33%. But are you really getting that much? You're getting more because of the taxable equivalent yield, which we'd have to calculate, but it depends on the individual person. If you're in a very high tax bracket, that's more like 5%, which is not bad. And then corporates, where's corporates? That's taxable. Here's corporates. If you go out to just above junk status, just above, you know, the first level of investment grade, you're getting 6-7%, which is what we expect from bonds over the long term. So interest rates are normalizing somewhat, but still, if you're, it's not too bad, you know, 30, it's not that great either, 4%, but that's AAA, you're getting 4% for 30 years. Cool? So often investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds they are evaluating are very close to one another. Treasury is paying 4.8, corporate bond is paying 5.1. That's a tight spread. That's 0.3%, but we don't say that, do we? No. We say 30 basis points. A basis point is 0.01%. So 0.01, sorry, I got that wrong. The basis point is 0.01%. So 1% equals 100 basis points. I don't know who came up with this idea, but get used to it because that's what you're going to hear with the talking heads on the internet and on the television screen. It's just 30 basis points. Whereas a wide spread means there's a big difference. Treasury's paying 3.2%, corporate's paying 8.2%, 5% difference, or 500 basis points. For several years, bond yield spreads were very tight throughout the 2000s, and then during the 2008-09 turmoil, the yield spreads widened to levels not seen in decades, where Treasury bonds fell quite a bit because people flew to quality, flight to quality, whereas corporates and munis, as we saw, you know, 15-16% for Ford bonds. And so now they've narrowed again. And as we saw, we see that it's widened a little bit. But here's a 30-year Treasury, 30-year AAA, it's a little over 1%. But see, here's a lot wider. This is a lot wider spread. Okay, so here is the effect of inflation on bond rates. We see we start off in 1960, and we see inflation picking up. That's the blue thing, right? No, the red one is inflation. The red one is inflation because it goes negative here in 2008 and 2009. And then we see bond yields following them until they broke the back of inflation in the late 70s, early 80s. And then inflation fell precipitously and bond yields fell. And then, boom, there we had deflation. And people are worried about inflation, which is something to be worried about. We don't want inflation on a grand scale. It's very harmful to people. But deflation is even worse. People say, what's wrong with that? You know, milk costs less. So the biggest component of inflation is wages. You want your wages to go down? No. So that was why people need to worry about deflation as much as inflation. So the yield curve is a graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. And normally, the yield curve is upward sloping. And that's what we call it. We call it upward sloping. Whereas sometimes the yield curve is downward sloping. That is very unusual. And when it happens, it usually means bad things. But normally we expect it to look something like this. 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10, 30 years. This is what it normally looks like. But sometimes this is what happens. You have a downward sloping curve. Right? Make sense? This is what we normally see, upward sloping curve. Sometimes we see a downward sloping curve. So here is the curve as of a couple weeks ago, April 8th. And what the New York Times is showing you, and Morningstar has it, and Fidelity has it. This is 1 year ago. 1 year ago was typical. We had short-term interest rates lower as we go up the yield curve, and then it sort of levels out, all went out to 30 years. 5 1 month, that's the light blue. The intermediate one is the month ago, and then the black, the dark, is what happened just a couple weeks ago, April 8th. And we see it's inverted in the 2 to 3 to 4 year, right? It's inverted 2 to 5 years or so, 10 years higher than the 3 and 6 months, but not much. And if this is why the Federal Reserve has stopped raising interest rates, because what they would do then is they would raise the short term above the long term. You with me, understand? They were raising, now the Federal Reserve Bank is a very difficult position. Do you have the chapter 10?
No.
No? Okay. Pass this back there. The Federal Reserve has a dual mandate. They have to keep inflation down. They have to make sure inflation doesn't get out of hand by issuing too much currency. But at the same time, they want to encourage full employment, meaning they want the economy to be working at all eight cylinders, so to speak, if you're a motorhead, on all guns, going full blazes. So the two are diametrically opposed. And what they saw, what they still see, they still say the economy is doing pretty well, and we see unemployment really low. People are finding jobs. Their job is to take away the punch bowl at the party. Their job is to don't let it get out of hand. Don't let the economy run ahead and then inflation spike. So they've been raising short-term interest rates. And when this normally happens because the economy is doing well, the long term also rises. Why? Because there's a bigger demand for cash, bigger demand for loans, and so the competition will drive up the rates on the long end, because the Fed doesn't play with the long end normally. They did during the Great Recession. But normally that's the bond market doing it. And the bond market saying, oh, no. No, we don't think the economy is that strong. We're going to keep rates low. We're going to accept lower rates because we don't think. In fact, we believe that we may even be going into recession. People keep talking about recession. When's it going to happen? So, why do longer-term debt securities normally have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities? Well, there are a few different hypotheses, expectations of future interest rates. We'll get back to that in just a couple minutes. Liquidity, maturity. We tend, as we said, prefer shorter term securities because there's a better chance for you to get your money back. And then the market is segmented into different locations. People are looking for money in 5 years, they're looking for money in 10 years, in 3 months, in 20 years, 30 years. So each of these makes sense. But how do we account for right now when the yield curve is inverting? What factors can cause a yield curve to incur, yield curve inversion, and what can it tell us about the economy of the future? It's happening right now, so you'll probably, if you just go on your cell phone or go on the internet or watch television for the talking heads, they're going to be talking about the inverted yield curve. Since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, where we have something that looks like this. Now, we don't have this. This is a archetypal or a typical this. We have something that looks like this. It's not really inverted the way we normally expect it to look. But every time that's happened, the economy's fallen into recession. There was one exception in 1966, where it just hit 0% growth. And you know what a recession means? Recession is defined as 2 quarters, 6 months of negative growth. Now, is that a stupid name or what? Negative growth? It means contraction, where instead of growing the pie, the economy, meaning the metaphor for economy of pie, instead of the pie getting bigger, the pie is getting smaller. And what is, we can't get our arms around that because we're just in a little hamster wheel doing our job. But that means cars aren't being built. Houses aren't being built. People are not getting employed. Are you with me? Understand? On a grand scale, it's very hard for any one of us to understand a $19, $20 trillion economy. We can't even get our hands around a billion, let alone a million. If a million is 1,000 billion, a billion is 1,000 millions. And then a trillion is 1,000 billions. Is every man had a wife, a man a wife? How many people are going to St. Ives? So right now there's a lot of consternation and gnashing of teeth and beating of breath because the yield curve has inverted, as we saw. Not really. I mean, it's look. Oh, where is it? Back here. Well, back way back. Where's the yield curve? What happened to the yield curve? There it is. Like, you see it? It's not quite an inversion, because what we would normally expect is to see something more like this. We expect to see something like that, look, like that. But we're not. We're just seeing, Who knows what's going on? That's the problem. So for 2 years, for example, the last recession we went through, 2008-09, for 2 years before the beginning of 2008, the yield curve was inverted ever so slightly, right? The bond market was predicting a recession for over 2 years. And the stock market, for the most part, just didn't believe it. Yeah, no, look, everything's fine. It wasn't. We were in a housing crisis. The housing bubble was about to burst. The stock market didn't believe him. It wasn't until the fall of 2008, when the wheels started to fall off, that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged that we were in a recession. It took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls were finally proven. Right. Why do we call them bond ghouls? Well, what happens in a recession? Negative growth, right? Contraction. There's less demand for money. Interest rates fall. The Federal Reserve Bank usually responds by lowering the short-term interest rates. What happens when interest rates fall? What happens to bond prices? Interest rates fall. You can't leave the bonds rise. Okay, but interest rates fall. Bond prices rise. Interest rates rise. So they're called, but then I don't know how many. I don't know that many in bond investors are just investments in bonds. But yes.
Two questions. So when the Fed jacks up interest rates, it's to slow down growth so that it can keep inflation kind of in check. But when it does that, according to this, it starts causing a recession, right?
Well, that's not their. That's not their intention. But it happens. Yeah, you're right. It does happen.
Is that like indicative that they probably jacked it up too high too fast?
You know, that's the problem. You go back, what's it called, Monday morning quarterbacking? You know, you go back in time and you see, you boneheads, you know, why did you do that? And there's an old saying, they raise rates until they break something. And the problem is, it's like trying to drive by looking in the rearview mirror. You understand? You can't see the future. I mean, they can barely make out what's going on right now. And then they get data 2-3 months old. So they're trying to project what's going to happen in the future. But it's pretty near impossible. And people will say, those bonus. I say, oh yeah? Let's see if you can do a better job. How many PhDs do you have besides your name? You know, these are people who are very intelligent. To get onto the Fed, you've got to be pretty good. Yeah.
It kind of makes sense, too, because I've heard different people say, oh, well, interest rates should be higher because the economy is doing so well. But then, you know, it would make sense that they're only raising it slowly for their own cause.
Are they bond investors? Probably not, because the bond investors are saying, no, the economy is not doing as well as people think. And that's the problem. You don't know until you, like in 2008, the recession officially happened at the beginning of 2008, as I remember. They didn't figure it out until August, September, when things started to really go badly. So it's very difficult. It's not easy to do. In hindsight, oh yeah, what the hell are you thinking, you goofballs? But trying to do it, you know, people say, and the Fed, what are you going to replace them with? Because the Federal Reserve chairperson is often called the second most powerful person in the United States. The president's the most powerful because he or she is the commander of the military. They have the missiles. But the Federal Reserve Bank controls the money supply. And oh boy, could they screw things up royally. You have too few dollars, and then people are out of jobs. People are out of jobs, they get very upset. This is why, you know, we have this tremendously low unemployment, but we're looking at entire industries, just the humans disappearing. Humans need not apply. And so what's going to happen when there's a lot of young people without jobs? I don't know. It's going to be difficult. But then, at the same time, if they put too much cash into the system, you get hyperinflation, and then you have problems like Zaire and Venezuela where the currency just collapses. And then you get people in the streets complaining. So it's a difficult job. Anybody want to be a Federal Reserve chairperson? No? Okay, first you got to make sure you get into Stanford or Yale or Harvard or Wharton School of Business at Penn University or University of Chicago. And don't tell me you ever went to Southwestern.
Okay.
What?
Join the
Yale Skull and Bone Society at Yale, and then you can be
Goldman Sachs for about
government Sachs, yeah. The government Sachs. The one guy they just removed Herman Cain's name from the, but they're trying to put this guy Stephen Moore, who basically said, I don't know anything about what I'm going to do. I don't know anything about this stuff, but they went. Trump wants to put him on the Federal Reserve Board, and it's probably not going to happen. We'll see. But the other guy, Herman Cain, he at least he had some business experience, but he's not going to get on there either. Okay, so cool. Now, so you understand, are we going to have a recession?
Yeah.
Do we know when?
No.
You read in the talking heads and you read in the pundits, next year. It's always next year. I think it's going to happen sooner, but that doesn't mean I'm right. Car sales are down. Anybody in the car business? Anybody in car sales? How's it?
Well, I buy and sell my own.
Oh, but you don't do new cars, right?
No.
It's like the worst it's been in like 10 years right now.
It's the worst it's been in 10 years, yeah. Car sales are plummeting. Housing, it's slowing, right? It's slowing. So we'll see. You know. Well, sure, but yeah, but we tend to go whoa, you know, we're more roller coaster. Yeah, I mean California as a general, and the East Coast, the right coast and the left coast, we're the center of the country, not so much, but everywhere you read, which is it's hard, you know, it's hard because again you're trying to drive with your in the rear view mirror. Okay. Bond pricing. Now, didn't I say bonds are kind of exciting? I lied. But they are. There's a little bit about bonds that's actually pretty exciting, and that's the pricing. Bond valuation. Bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flows. Does that sound familiar? We have semi-annual interest payments. They pay us every 6 months. So when we say that a 5% bond is paying us $50, it's really paying us $25 every 6 months. And then we get back our principal after 10, 20, 30 years. Although there are other factors, such as the creditworthiness. Is it a bona fide operation? Are they going to be in business in 4 or 5 years? If the issuer runs into trouble, we're going to see bonds being dumped. The price will fall because investors will be afraid of default. So, the formula is bond price, the expected bond price, is equal to the present. I like to use PV. Have you ever been to Puerto Vallarta? PV, Puerto Vallarta, present value of the interest income, plus the present value of the principal repayment. So we're going to get the $50 or whatever it is, $60, $30 twice each year over the next 10 years, 20 years. Plus, we're going to get our $1,000 back. Now, some bonds are $5,000, $10,000, but here we'll always do $1,000. Now, we really should do semi-annual compounding since bonds pay interest every 6 months. Well, the annual compounding is easier to compute, and it will give you almost the exact same answer, so who cares? That's why we have spreadsheets. So here are the formulas. Now, I don't know why I did this. I did it a long time ago, and I stopped doing it, and I'm doing it again. I made it a different color. You like that? The formula sheet? Because here's the present value tables. I don't know. That's maybe what I'm doing. So I normally would remember the present value tables I put in the other packet, but that was I thought it made it a little hard to goof with. So, as we did with the discounted cash flow model, we will show you a spreadsheet that will make life a whole lot easier. So here's an example of a company. Ever hear of them? You ever hear of this company? Ever hear of Halliburton? Yeah, this is one of their competitors. Actually, this company is bigger than Halliburton. And I've heard it pronounced Schlumberger. I've also heard it pronounced Schlumberger. I don't know which one it is. I think it's Schlumberger because it originally was a French company, but now it's based in Houston. It's a global company. But they build the oil refineries. They don't drill the oil. They're the ones who are creating all the material, the equipment for the oil refineries. And I think they do a few other things, but they're in the oil business. But they're not an oil company. They make stuff for the oil companies. So here is a 4.3% bond paying us $43, $21.50 every 6 months, and it's due 10 years from now. At the time we looked at it, it was priced to yield 3.974%. So that means the current yield, take the $43 divided by the price, was 4.190. It's rated AA-, which means, hey, Schlumberger's not going anywhere. And since 3.974 is close to 4%, let's use 4% for 9 years. And I chose it because of that. Why? Because the tables only go per year, per whole interest rate. So that's why I chose it. Obviously, with a spreadsheet, you don't care about the table. It does the calculation automatically. So how do we do this? We take the present value of the... What is that? That's weird. The present... Oh, that's supposed to be this thing down there. The present value of the interest income plus the present value of the repayment. So what are we going to get every year in interest? $43. Now, if this were Chapter 6, what we would do is we would multiply $43 in year number 1 times the present value multiplier for year number 1. And year number 2, we'd multiply $43 times the present value multiplier for year number 2. And then year number 3 and 4. And probably got to do that 9 times. So what we do in Chapter 10 is we add another table. So the table on the right, it's actually the same table as Chapter 6. That's the present value multiplier for a single lump sum, which is what we did in Chapter 6. Year 1, year 2, year 3. But this table on the left makes it easier for us. The table on the left says, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to multiply $43 times a present value multiplier for 9 years, not just 1 year. So this is 4% for 9 years, go across to 4%, down 9 years, and you should see 7.345. Is that what? I wrote it wrong. I got to fix this thing. Ay, Paquito. Is it 435? I hope I did the calculation right. Would you want to do that calculation? It's 43 times 7.435. Let's see if I did it right. 319.703? Yeah, okay, good. At least I just typed it wrong. I'm sorry. I got to fix that. Okay. So that's what the $43 over the next 9 years every month is worth to us today. All right, we're going to get $43 times 9. Well, what is that? That's like, 43 times 9. What is it? 4 times 9 is 30. So it's almost $400. Not quite $400. But because we're discounting that at 4%, today that $43 over the next 9 years is worth $319. Yeah? Okay. And then we're going to get a one-time payment of $1,000 after 9 years. So that's the table on the right. That's the table we're used to. Go across 4%, down 9 years, and you should see, unless I screwed up. Seven, I didn't screw up that one. And that's easy to do, right? You just move the decimal point 3 to the right, or do your calculating. So that's $1,000 that we're going to get 9 years from now, today is worth to us $703 at 4%. Or is it a different discount rate? It's worth different. So you add those two together, and this bond should be about $1,022.71. The quoted price was $1,026. The bond calculator on the spreadsheet gives us $1,024 for annual payments and $1,027.02 for semi-annual payments. You see what's going on here? Looks pretty darn close, right? The estimates for bond calculations are a hell of a lot more reliable than what we get from stocks, just because bonds are fixed. Unless the world ends for Schlumberger, we're going to get $43 every year for the next 9 years, and we're going to get $1,000 back. Okay? So let's take a look at the spreadsheet. And where is the spreadsheet? This is the wrong class. Chapter 10, here it is. Bonds, calculator spreadsheet. So you type, and you type in the gray areas. Oh, poo. Let's download. I'm sorry. I should have logged in. Download as Microsoft excuse. And called up in Microsoft Excel. Okay, yes, enable editing. I'm not. You type in the coupon yield, the last quote. It calculates the current yield. You put in the maturity date, put in the price to yield, the principal, the rating, call it all in, but that's nothing there. And it does the annual payments, but then, because it's a spreadsheet, it's a calculated computer, it gives us the semi-annual. This is a better estimate because we're going to get, you know, half of that, half of $43.21.50 every 6 months. Piece of cake. Then, I didn't put it in there. That's out. Okay. So we're going to now do a couple of, this is, I know, kind of nonplussed. All right, so let's do number four, right? So chapter 10 worksheet, everybody got it? You need one? Okay. Worksheet number one, number four. Using annual compounding. Well, let's watch over. We're going to look at a 9% bond that's been priced to yield 7%. So now, before we do any calculation, should this be a premium bond or a discount bond? 9% bond priced to yield 7%. Interest rates have gone down. It should be a premium. It should be a premium bond. Yeah. Interest rates have gone down. Price should have gone up. So this is a 9% bond. What is it paying us every year? Everyone's just saying $90. How many years? 10 years maturity, and it's priced to yield 7%. Now here's the tricky part. People will use this one for the table. No, you use this one. This is what it was originally. The interest rates were originally 9% when this bond came in for like bonds, but now interest rates have fallen. So we use this guy. So, PV of the interest payments? Puerto Vallarta of the interest payments? Plus PV of the principal. So what's the interest payments for a 9% bond? $90, not 90 cents. And so, it's a 10-year bond priced to yield 7%. Which table do we use for the interest payments? The one on the left. You use the one on the left. Go across the 7%. What it's priced to yield? 7.024? Okay. And then we're going to multiply that times the $1,000 principal that we're going to get back in 10 years. But that's a one-time payment. So which table do we use? The one on the right. We use the one on the right because we're not going to get $1,000 every year. We're going to get $1,000 once. So go across the 7% down 10 years. 5.508? Okay, so it's 90 times 7.024. 632.65? Oh, I'm sorry, 16. Question? Okay, what are we going to get back when the bond matures? $1,000. So we're going to get $1,000 payment, assuming Schlumberger is still in business whatever this is. Assuming the bond doesn't go into default, we're going to get $1,000 back. And so we're going to discount that $1,000 because it's not worth $1,000 to us today. We're not getting it for 10 years. So at 7%, it's worth $508. And how do you do that? Just move the decimal place to 3 to the right, or multiply times 1,000, either one. So if you add the 632.16 plus 508, what's this bond should be paying? Should be a... It should be somewhere very close to $1,140.16, depending on the creditworthiness of the issuer. If people believe that the creditworthiness is not very good, they will discount the bond. They will charge less for it, pay less for it. Okay, B is, yeah, I know, I'm sorry. Bonds are boring, I'm sorry. So now we have a 5% 20-year bond that is priced to yield 8%. So without knowing anything else, what should we? Should this be a premium bond? Have interest rates risen or have interest rates fallen? Should be a discount bond. Interest rates have risen, so the bond price should fall. It should be a discount bond. So before you even do the calculation, you should know that. Okay, so what is the 5% bond paying us? Everyone should say $50. They might think I'm crazy. You may be right, but it helps you think. Helps you learn. And so the present value of the interest is equal to $50. Now, it's 20 years price to yield 8%. So which table do we use, left or right? The left one. Go across to 8% down 20 years. What's the present value multiplier? 818. And then add to that the present value of the principal. You don't have to write out what I'm writing out. I just want to make it simple. Okay. $1,000. Because remember, in this class, it's always 1,000. Some places it's 5,000, 10,000. So, times now. Again, which table do we use? One-time payment, the right table. Go across to 8%, down 20 years, 215. Okay, so 50 times 9.818 is about 4-something? $490.90 plus that you can do in your head, 215. So was that 800? No. 705.90. So this bond has fallen quite a bit. Cool? It's not hard. I don't think it's that hard, but of course I've been doing it for a long time. But if you do it, you just, because then there's a worksheet number 2, right? And then there's a worksheet number 3, and we'll go over those. We'll review them on. So it doesn't look like we're not going to have exam next Tuesday. No, because we don't have time. So the next exam will be next Thursday, and we'll have a little bit of time extra on Tuesday, and maybe we'll do some offhand stuff. Who knows what we'll do? Maybe play a little bit with net present value. Okay. Now, I got to fix a couple things. Slide number 32. Fix. Okay. Now, the last few slides that normally don't pertain to us, but at the very least, we want to understand what's going on with the short term versus the long term. Many people will buy bond funds after they've been burnt by stock funds, or maybe they'll buy bonds after they've burnt by stocks, because people will tell them, oh, you know, stocks are really risky, really. Bonds are less risky. But do we see times when bonds fall? And so you'll hear people, or they might not even understand this, and then when interest rates rise, that the first sign of their bond fund going down, they panic, they scream and holler, or they go, oh, interest rates are going to go up. You know, should I sell my bond funds? And the answer is, goofball, you don't have to say that part. If you're in it for the long term, that's what you want. You want interest rates to rise. Why? You're going to get more money. Yeah, it goes. First of all, it goes down, and you get to buy more. you're going to get more interest in the future. You understand? If you extend your time horizon, yeah, your bond fund, your bonds are going to go down, but you're always getting in interest payments. You're always getting bond principal payments. And so you have to reinvest those dollars, unless you're living off the income, then you don't care. But it's called reinvestment risk. The uncertainty about the future value of an investor's bond investments that results from the need to reinvest bond interest payments and redemptions at yields not known in advance. So you're getting this amount of interest, and then interest rates go up. Your bond goes down, or your bond mutual fund goes down. But all those interest payments coming in are now buying new bonds at a higher interest rate, which is cool, right? I mean, if you have a long-term perspective, yeah. Extend your time horizon. Again, what we talked about in stock. Just keep a long-term. Unless you need the cash now, then you know, you've got a problem. If interest rates fall, people, oh, look, my bond portfolio went up. But now the money that's coming in is being reinvested at a lower interest rate. Are you with me? So don't be frightened by higher interest rates. Assuming you have a long-term perspective, if you're in it for the long-term. Short-term, if you're a trader, then, you know, good luck. So, let's read together. I think I already explained it. Changing interest rates don't only affect the price of your bonds. They also affect your future income as you need to reinvest the interest income and bond payments. If interest rates have fallen, your income level will fall as you reinvest your income and bond repayments. Likewise, if interest rates have risen, your income level will rise. Many of us are going to be buying bonds through mutual funds. It ain't our problem. The mutual fund manager has to deal with it. Now, whoops. The duration is a measurement that we're not going to do. We're not going to do the calculation. Just look it up. It's a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. This captures the price, the current price, and the reinvestment risk that we looked on the previous slide. It's used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. The duration of a bond changes as it approaches its maturity date, and current interest rates change. In general, the longer the bond's maturity, the longer its duration, the word, but the higher the bond's nominal rate, the shorter its duration. So the shorter the duration, the less price volatility. So the idea is, look, I want to have this money in 5 years. I'm going to buy bonds that have a duration of 5 years. Now, they might mature longer, they might mature shorter, but because of the interest rate environment, they'll have a duration of 5 years. So I'm protected against interest rate swings. And they use this term immunization, which I think is a bad term to use because it's they're not viruses. But investors who have a specified time horizon can use bond immunization to increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. The idea is you keep the average duration of your bond investments equal to your time horizon. You would thus be more protected against interest rate-induced price swings. The problem with this is it requires constantly balancing of your bond portfolio. Now, as we saw, $25,000 minimum, like bond investors tend to have, you know, millions of dollars, or maybe they don't. We don't know that. But who has millions, billions of dollars? The mutual fund managers, the pension fund managers, the life insurance companies. So this is more important to them than it is to us little peons on the streets. The three investment strategies we see with bonds are income. You purchase the bond simply for interest income. Capital gains, trying to decide when interest rates are going to fall, when they're going to rise. And then total return, which is a combination of both. The easiest to do is income. The hardest to do is capital gains. And then you will see some bond funds called a total return bond fund, as opposed to an income bond fund. An income bond fund is trying to just take advantage of the income. Where you see total return, they want income, but they also want to, you know, do some speculation about what interest rates are going to happen. And that, of course, is harder to do. Bond laddering. Bond laddering is the strategy of purchasing bonds with staggering maturities. You purchase some bonds with short-term maturities, some with intermediate-term maturities, and some with long-term maturities. Diversification. It's a very popular strategy with pension funds, life insurance companies, bond mutual fund managers, since they have considerable sums of money to invest. What is the advantage? Diversification. What is the disadvantage? Diversification. Huh? As we'll see in chapter 11, where we try to tie everything together, diversification is a wonderful thing. But it also means something in your portfolio is going to piss you off every year. You're going to be unhappy with something. And that something is probably the thing that's going to do better the next year, or was the best last year. And that's the, you know, that's the thing about diversification. It's a good thing, but it also isn't going to make us exciting when things go really, really up high and then really, really sad when things go down. So here's the ladder. It's yours. You can use it. Again, I stole from Fidelity. And we see the, where is it? 3 months, 6 months, higher than the 5 year. Not higher than the 10 year, though, treasuries. And then they got some corporates in there. And folks, I cannot get excited about a treasury bond paying us 3% for the next 30 years. These people are locked in at 3%, which is where inflation is, right? Inflation, well, right now, it's below that. But over the long sweep of time, inflation is about 3%. So that means whatever money you put in now will be worth about the same in 30 years. I think you can do a whole lot better than that. But that's me. And who knows? Interest rates could plummet like they did in the Great Recession. And that is our bond excitement. You excited about bonds?
No.
Me neither. Okay. But you got to know them, folks. You got to know them. Because are bonds reliable? Yes. And if you have somebody who's terrified of the stock market, or if you're terrified of the stock market, where are you going to put your money? Bonds. Or maybe real estate. But real estate's tricky, as we'll see. Real estate ain't easy. Real estate. I'll take another one. I think I'm going to do enough. Okay. So now, let's take a few minutes to look at hybrid. I think I'm going to do the abbreviated. And then maybe we'll come back to it, depending on what goes on. It's Thursday. Who knows? We might do it Tuesday. I don't know. No. That just means one fewer day to do stuff. Okay. Yes. One more. My apologies. Okay, close that. Hello. Oh, I just cracked. Okay, this is the long one. And this one's 18 slides, right? No, this is the step. This is the short one. This is the short one. Let's do the short one. Okay. At the beginning of the semester, when we looked at our investment universe, overview of the investment universe, we just had a few lines, a few pieces of information about what are called hybrid securities. And the idea is you want the best of both worlds. The problem with these things is they also have the disadvantages of both worlds. You know, nothing's free, right? And so we're going to find that preferred stocks sound really cool. Because, I mean, wouldn't you rather have preferred stocks than simply common stocks? But the answer is no, you really don't want them. Although some people might. And then convertible securities sound really cool because it reminds you of a convertible sports car with the hair blowing through your wind or whatever, and wind blowing through your hair. And yet, no, they're not that exciting. And maybe you might find something great. But what are preferred stocks? Well, these are stocks that live between bonds and common stocks. They have a prior claim ahead of the common stocks, but beneath the bond holders. Bond holders are first in line if something goes wrong, right? They get first claims on the assets. Preferred are next, and then stockholders are last. But usually, the bondholders have picked over the carcass. You know, preferred and the common stockholders are not going to get anything. They're also called hybrid securities. Some people call them fixed income stocks. Some people lump them in with bonds. They throw them in with bonds, which is not true. I mean, they're not debt. They are equity. But they tend to pay a fixed dividend. Sometimes it's called the percentage of par. They say these stocks, the par value is $100. Now, that's not what the price is. But we're going to pay you $7, 7% preferred. Every year, you're going to get $7 on each share. They don't go up. Didn't we see how some common stocks raise their dividends over time as the company does well? Isn't that cool? I think so. But preferreds tend to stay fixed, like a bond. But they represent equity, and it doesn't count as debt on the corporate balance sheet. They are not interest payments. They are dividends. So you see how they have a little bit of both worlds? They're fixed like a bond, but they're paying you dividends. And they are not debt. So those bonds, those dividend payments are not mandatory. What are the advantages? Highly predictable income stream, excellent record of meeting dividend payments, and here's the kicker. If you're a corporation, and we're not corporations, we're individual investors, but if a corporation buys these preferred stocks, they get tax benefits. They get to write off some of the dividend that they receive, and they don't have to pay taxes. So right off the bat, we're at a disadvantage, we individual investors, because we have to pay everybody like everybody else as if they were dividends from a stock, which they are. But if you're a corporation, then you pay, I think it's 65% of what you owe. So in your Warren Buffett, and you run Berkshire Hathaway, this is what he uses when you hear him, when you read or hear them say he just invested $5 billion in Goldman Sachs. In the Great Recession, GE, GE, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America all needed cash. And who was there with cash? The contrarian investor? Mr. Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway. He bought newly issued preferred stock from Goldman Sachs, 10%. 10% preferred. So on his $5 billion investment, every year, Goldman Sachs had to pay him $500 million. And to buy back those shares, Goldman Sachs had to pay a penalty, a prepayment penalty, of another $500 million. Now, do you think you or I are going to get that kind of deal? Plus, they have tax advantages because Berkshire Hathaway is a corporation, so they don't pay as much taxes. So, of course, Goldman Sachs paid off that loan, basically what it was a loan, as quickly as they could, right? Because, well, I don't think we have it. I should go back. We should go back. We've got a little time. One of the cool things of most preferred is that it is cumulative. We should go back to the other. Wait till we go through here. We'll go through here. It is cumulative. Most preferred is cumulative preferred. And what does that mean? Let's hang on a minute. Now, what are the disadvantages? Well, it's got the problems of bonds in that it's susceptible to inflation because your return is fixed. Dividends can be suspended or postponed, unlike bonds, which have to be paid. And you don't really get the big substantial capital gains that you normally get from common stock, and they don't pay as well as bonds. So they have some of the advantages of stocks and bonds and some of the disadvantages that are hybrids. Now, let's go back to the other one. My apologies. I really should not do this. How are we doing? Ask me if I know what I'm doing. Come on. Where's the chapter? Is that it? This is it. No, that's the wrong one. That's it. Okay, let's ask me if I know what I'm doing. Where's the cumulative? Okay, the calculations. Ah, here it is, number 8. Cumulative versus, okay, by the way, there are senior and junior. This is the pecking order of senior and junior bonds having more priority. But We saw in chapter 5 when we dealt with stocks that the company doesn't have to pay the dividends. I mean, some companies have been paying dividends for 100 years. But they can suspend the dividends at any time. And they're in no obligation to pay you in the future. Whereas preferred, sure, they can suspend the dividends, just like common stock. But if they are cumulative preferred, that means before you pay any common stock holders any more dividends, you have to pay me the dividends you didn't pay me. Say you decided to stop paying for 1 year, and so I didn't get my $7. Before you can pay the common stockholders, you have to pay me the dividends that are said to be in arrears. Have you heard that saying, in arrears? In other words, they owe it to you. Back pay. The in arrears dividends must be paid before any other dividends can be paid. Preferred or common. So that's a very cool feature of preferred stock for those people who are interested in the dividends. But throughout, I've been around for a while. I've only known two people actually invested in these things. And one of them wasn't too excited about it. The other guy, that's what he did. He wasn't my client. He was my boss's client. And he would call her and say, I want to buy 20,000 bucks or whatever. Obviously, he had a lot of money. I want to buy a ton of this preferred stock right before they would pay the dividend. He would earn his dividend, and then he would sell the shares. And so, you know, he's trying to juice the dividends out of these preferred stocks, and that was his strategy. Cool. Okay, now let's come back. Okay, Callabar, this is not participating. Yeah, we'll come back to this later. Okay, now. Let us take a look at the formulas, because they're pretty darn straightforward. Let's just go right to the worksheet. Here's the easiest 5 points all semester long. Are you cool with that? Let's go to chapter 18, the worksheet I just gave you. The calculations for convertibles are pretty darn straightforward. And remember, all the bonds in this class will always have $1,000. Face value, par value. Oh, wait a minute. Ooh, this is the convertible stuff. Yeah, let's do it. Convertible bond. Maybe not. Maybe, you know what? Are you guys thoroughly confused? Yeah? Darn. No, I'm sorry. No, I don't mean to do that. Let's go back, and let's go back and do the convertible now. Now, convertible securities. Now, this could be preferred stock or convertible bonds. So it would be convertible, preferred stock, or convertible bonds. And we'll just deal with convertible bonds. Convertible bonds or convertible preferred stock are called deferred equity. It means that those things can be converted into common stock. Once you do that, you can't go back. You have a convertible bond. If you convert it into stock, that's it. You now own the stock. And so that's why they sometimes call them deferred equity. We sometimes call it a kicker, equity kicker. If you go buy a bond, I mean, that's all you're going to get. You're going to get your interest payments. You're going to get your $1,000. Or if you buy the stock and the stock explodes, whee-bee, you're going to do really well. The bondholders, no. They get their money back and that's it. So if you have a convertible bond and the stock explodes, yippee, because then you can take that bond, turn it into stock, and make a ton of money. Sound too good to be true? It doesn't always happen. I don't know. I've never seen it happen because I don't get involved with these things. But let's say you have a $1,000 bond and it has a 20-share conversion ratio. That means you could turn in that $1,000 bond and they will give you 20 shares of stock. It's that simple, really. It's not that hard. So there's a conversion period, sometimes deferred for 5, 10 years. There's the conversion ratio that we just talked about, 20 shares for one bond. And then there's the conversion price. the price at which the common stock will be delivered to the investor, and not just the $1,000 divided by the $20. Now, if the stock were selling less than $50, would we bother to convert? No, but if the stock were selling for $100, we could convert that $1,000 bond into 20 shares at $100 a share and double our money. Okay, the conversion value is the indication of what a convertible security would trade for if it were... Yes, I'm sorry.
So is it determined by, like if it's a corporate bond, it has to be like that company?
Yeah.
Okay.
You buy a convertible bond for Schlumberger. That one wasn't convertible. You buy a convertible bond for Schlumberger and the stock price explodes, the price of your bond is going to go up. You could sell the bond, or you could say, I'll take the 20 or 50 shares or whatever it is.
Okay.
Sounds exciting, doesn't it?
Well, it's if you're into like trading in the stock market, it's a good tool to, you know.
I don't know. I've never watched. All I know is the one guy said, "Yeah."
Easier access and more expensive.
Exactly. Well, you hope. You hope, right? But what tends to be, it tends to. I don't know.
It,
that's the idea. It could be, but I don't know that it will be. So on Thursday, what we'll do is we'll review this really quickly. We'll do the worksheet. Easiest 5 points all semester long. Okay, is that a deal? I promise you. Wait till we do these calculations. You'll go, oh, yeah, this is pretty straightforward.
What about the test questions where you give us the answer?
Oh, they're on the website. Okay, here they are. That's a good question. Let's go to the class. Let's go to the, assuming I know what I'm doing. There it is. If you go to the website, you'll see, they're not here. They're under.
Answer key?
No, that's for the worksheet. They're up here under announcements. Here, the three questions about hybrid securities on exam number 4.
Oh.
So remember, it's going to be about exam number 4, which will not be next Tuesday. It'll be next Thursday, not this Thursday, next Thursday. It'll be about bonds. So study bonds. I'm not going to give you the answers to those. But there'll be three questions about preferred stock and convertible securities. And it's, you know, because they're not just not that important, but you do need to understand them. Because here's the question you're going to get from somebody: well, wouldn't I rather have preferred stock than common stock? And what do you say?
No.
You don't want preferred stock. That's for Warren Buffett. It ain't for us. Although you might be interested, you know, you might say, I like the fixed idea that it's going to pay me a certain amount of money. I don't know. Okay, so on Thursday, we'll finish this up, and then we'll... Now, I don't know about you, but whenever a professor says that, it really scares me, because I had a professor. We didn't know what the hell we were doing, what he was doing all semester long. He said, and now, next week, we'll wrap everything up. And I know many of you are a little bit confused, but I think this will really put things in perspective. And then we're all going, okay. And then as he's going through, we're looking at each other, you understand? But that's what we're going to do. We're going to go all the way back to the beginning and wrap everything we've done together into asset allocation and diversification. So we'll see you on Thursday. And anybody sneak in? People sneak.